We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bojovics. Joining me today is Daryl Bricker, CEO of Ipsos Public Affairs. He's a social political researcher, commentator, and author of 6 best-selling books, including How I Found Him, the author of Empty Planet, The Shock of Global Population Decline. Daryl, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me on.
So this is going to be obviously a bit of a departure from what we normally talk about on Palisades Gold Radio, but I think it's a really interesting and obviously a very important topic to be able to talk about and kind of be able to include in the calculus when we're thinking about economies and growth and, you know, where the world is really headed. So maybe we can start by asking you a little bit about what is some of the data that you present to people to kind of shock them into this reality of where the global population is actually headed.
Well, usually there's a lot of data out there, but people just don't correlate it or bring it together to tell the overall picture. Mm-hmm. So usually what I look at are fertility rates. So the number of children women are having in countries around the world during their lifetimes. There's been a general decline in that. Mm-hmm. We look at population aging. When you're not having kids, the population ages. So how rapidly are we aging? And then the third thing is what that actually does to the size of the population. And some aspects of that include the distribution of the population. So when you put all that information together, it paints a pretty specific picture of what the future is going to be. Mm-hmm.
So maybe we could also get to kind of wrap our heads around this. This is a problem that is going in a negative direction, right? Since you guys wrote the book, I believe you kind of started in 2016, 2017. Have these trends actually accelerated?
Very definitely so. And when we wrote the book, it came out in 2019. We were saying, for example, that China, because this was the consensus at the time, mm-hmm. Its population was going to start to decline in the mid-2030s. Well, China's population started to decline last year. But, you know, Tom, never ceases to amaze me how every time I go to like a global economics conference or, you know, a big thinkers kind of conversation, mm-hmm. the conversation about China that takes place is about its, you know, its economic strength going into the 21st century. And it's like, how do you do that when you're going to lose half your population? So it's not even that the population is declining, it's collapsing. Mm-hmm. So China, even the most optimistic projections about what its future population have it going to, has it declining by nearly 50%. And what's left will be really, really old. Mm-hmm. So what is this mega, you know, economic effect that they're going to have through the 21st century? Well, if economies are driven by people, they're going to have a lot less of them, a lot fewer of them, and they're going to be a lot older. Mm-hmm.
So Daryl, over what time span does that end up kind of playing out? You know, when we think about 50% of their population disappearing, is that, you know, in the next 10 years? Is it over the next 100 years? You know, how quickly does that take effect?
Oh, it's taking place really rapidly. So if you take a look at what the projections were that the UN was putting out, even 5 years ago, mm-hmm. they had the global population getting to 11.2 billion people by the end of the century. And, you know, think, okay, the end of the century is a long way away. Well, the end of the century is about 70 years away. Mm-hmm. It's not that far away. And now the UN, just in 5 years, has reduced its estimate of what the global population is going to be. They put out a new estimate in 2022, and it declined by 800 million people, almost a billion people in just 5 years. So it's just going to keep going down like that, and that's because this is accelerating. So the way that I like to explain this is to think of the year 2030. The year 2030, which is, we're talking here in 2024, 6 years away, the entire global baby boom, will be retirement age. By the time we get to 2040, mm-hmm. to 2050, most of those people will be leaving this mortal coil. So it's that fast. It's not 2100. Mm-hmm. It's mid-century.
It's almost, you know, basically in the next 25 years.
It's all happening right now. And in many countries, it's already happening. I mean, Japan loses about 1 million people from its population every year. Mm-hmm. Well, Italy loses close to 100,000.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to get to speaking about some of these very, you know, specific sure. examples. But, you know, to help us wrap our heads around this a little bit more, the UN actually put out three different estimates, right? And I'd like you to walk us through those, if you could.
Okay, so there's three estimates they have, that what they call the high variant, the low variant, or the medium variant and the low variant. Mm-hmm. The one they report as their projection is what they call the median variant. And the median variant right now says that we are going to peak sometime in like the 2080s and decline to about 10.4 billion people by the end of the century. So the current population is about 8 billion people. So we're going to add close to another 2.5 billion people. Mm-hmm. Then they have what they call the high variant. And that goes, you know, well, like 14 billion people. And that's if women on average in the world have half a kid more mm-hmm. in their lifetime. And then they have what's the low variant. And that's if they have half a kid less than the median variant. The median variant's around 2.1, which is replacement rate. So the average woman in her lifetime having 2.1 kids, the 0.1 is for children who don't age into adulthood. Mm-hmm. But so 2.1 is where the UN sees this, a natural fertility rate kind of establishing itself. But if we're a half a kid higher or half a kid lower, the differences are extreme. Mm-hmm. What looks to be most likely is we're probably going to be looking more like the lower variant. And if we're at the lower variant, it's going to be closer to about 7 billion people. So losing a billion more people than we currently have today. If we go to the high variant, half a kid more, it's probably going to be up around 14 billion. Mm-hmm. So where are we? Probably somewhere between the median variant and the low variant, but I would say biasing towards the low variant.
Mm-hmm. And just to, I guess, make that crystal clear, the number of babies that is it each woman needs to produce yeah. is 2.1, right?
Correct.
Just to be able to, you know, maintain our current populations, right?
Yeah, replace the number of people who are dying every year. Mm-hmm.
So in most Western countries, where is our birth rate now? Let's say Canada, the US, using some of those examples.
Almost without exception, below replacement rate. Mm-hmm.
So are governments ever capable of, you know, really stimulating birth rates by implementing any type of program?
Not really, no. And the reason that you know that is because you take a look at the Nordic countries, which are doing more on this than anybody is, mm-hmm. or a place like France, where they do more on this than just about anybody does, and they're all below replacement rate and declining. Mm-hmm.
So obviously there are lots of factors that go into that, but urbanization seems to be one of the biggest ones. Is that right?
Yeah, it is, because what happens is that the lives of women change when they move into an urban environment mm-hmm. where they come into contact with different ways of living their lives and pursuing an education, getting married later, if getting married later at all, developing access to their own independent incomes and making different decisions about their families. Mm-hmm. And so they decide they want to live different lives than their mothers or their grandmothers lived. And the first place that you do that is by having fewer kids.
So where are birth rates, let's say, lowest in the world right now, Darryl?
Asia.
Okay.
Asia. So China, South Korea is probably the lowest in the world. It's down to like, I think the number I saw today was 0.8. I mean, South Koreans are disappearing. Mm-hmm. The Japanese are disappearing. And then places like Western Europe. But with the exception of Africa, just about every country in the world is a replacement rate or lower. Even places like Bangladesh mm-hmm. has a birth rate, I think, of about 1.6.
So taking into consideration these high birth rates in Africa, that's also seeming to come down as well, because, you know, over the course of the book, you explain why these things are changing in such a dramatic fashion, right?
Yeah, well, basically why they're changing, Tom, is culture. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not that it's kind of a biological imperative that's creating a situation in which people are having fewer kids, although aging does create that imperative. It's that we've just decided we don't want to really participate in the creation of the next generation. Mm-hmm. We're the first species in the history of the planet that has decided next generation, somebody else's problem. Mm-hmm. And we're not competing to better the next generation. So as a result of that, we've decided we want fewer. And, you could put it down to the things that you usually hear, which are, people are very concerned about global warming, so they're having fewer kids. A very small number of people, that's the reason. People are, they can't afford kids. Yeah, there's some people who say that they really can't afford kids, but even if you made them free, would they have three kids? The answer is probably not. Mm-hmm. It's just that they've decided to live a different kind of life with smaller camp families and fewer kids. And as a result of that, when you add it all up, it creates the trends that we describe in Empty Planet. Mm-hmm.
So let's take this, to the next step. When we're thinking about a society, a young society that is very centered around raising families, that obviously creates a lot of consumerism, consumption, right? So that ends up driving the economy. So when we're aging as a population, and maybe we can take Japan as an example of this, how does that end up changing the economics of how a country works?
Well, Japan's done two things. One, it's become non-consumptive. So they're not buying a ton of things. Mm-hmm. And the second thing is they basically offshored their labor. So why are there Japanese plants in North America building cars? Well, yeah, it's good to be close to the customers, but they just don't have enough young people in Japan to be in those jobs. And they could solve it with robots, which is obviously something that Japan is leading the world in. Mm-hmm. But the problem is robots don't buy anything. Right? But robots don't buy cars. Robots don't buy new houses. Robots don't buy anything. And that level of consumption is what drove, in particular, since the end of the Second World War, the growth of the global economy. Mm-hmm. So if consumption is declining, then economies will be difficult to grow. And when you have older populations, these are not consumptive populations. They're basically, hoarding sounds like such a negative word, but they're people who are holding on to their assets, and they're not consuming at the level that they used to, not just because they're hoarding, but because they just don't need the things that they needed when they were raising families and they were younger. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we're setting ourselves up for a period in world global history in which consumption is going to become a real issue and low growth in our economy is going to become a real issue. There are a lot of people who celebrate that, but the consequences of it are pretty dire.
Absolutely. So, what are some of the, let's say, the consequences that you guys have thought through that you could point to that most people maybe, that it wouldn't come to the top of their minds?
Well, consumption is the obvious one where it's like, buying all the things that you would buy earlier in your life. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, for a lot of people, it puts you into debt and it's a hard thing to do, but you get out of it as you get older. Well, that drives a lot of the economy. So buying new cars, building houses, buying clothes, buying, stuff for your kids, all the things that are related to that is what drives a lot of the economic growth. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have that, then what's driving economic growth? Well, the answer is nothing. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're in a situation in which you've got people using a lot of government services, so older populations with pensions, and also dealing with things like, for example, the explosion in dementia that's going to be taking place, which is absolutely correlated with age, and trying to manage paying for all of that, it's going to be incredibly difficult. Mm-hmm. So we're moving into a period in which the largest part of your population is non-consumptive in the way that consumer economies are consumptive, but they are also big users of government and other services to deal with the aging that they'll be going through. So, yeah, if this is the structure of the economy, it's not an economy we're used to. Mm-hmm.
Well, in the book, you give a couple examples of populations or countries that have already pushed, let's say, the retirement age out so that they can keep some of these people in the workforce. Is that kind of one of these natural solutions or, band-aids at this point to one of those problems?
It is, but temporarily. Mm-hmm. Because the median age of the population is increasing overall. So at some point there won't be enough people who are in that category to really help the workforce. But in the short to medium term, yeah, that's one of the things that we have to revisit. But you see how politically difficult it is looking at what they're, for example, doing in France to try to expand the age of, well, they did to expand the age of retirement there. There's chaos in the streets. And in a lot of countries, that potentially could be the case. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the thing about older people is they vote. They've got time on their hands. They're politically engaged. Mm-hmm. It's a tough one. So, yeah, you can try it, and there will be a certain segment of the population that actually wants to work longer. So maybe something there. But then what we're going to have to start thinking about is how we even design our offices to accommodate older people, or our mm-hmm. production facilities to accommodate older people. I mean, ageism is the last ism that we can kind of joke about. Well, you know what? All those wonderful open office concepts in which we're going to be sparking off of each other and creating all of these wonderful ideas are noisy places with a lot of ambient noise, difficult to work in. Mm-hmm. So how are they designed for older members of the population? We're going to have to start thinking about these things, and we just simply haven't been.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you brought up earlier that China has this workforce, and they're poised, or let's say projected, to bring all of this growth into the world. You know, I've heard the argument that they can basically export their labor force to another younger country, but how does that end up affecting the country itself? Do they have the ability to, you know, basically make that work from just, let's say, a labor standpoint by doing what the rest of the world did to them in the beginning?
Yeah. So the only place they can do that in is Africa. Mm-hmm. I mean, to a certain extent, maybe India or Pakistan. Mm-hmm. But the problem that you've got in those places is they're not, with the exception of India, they're not politically stable places. They're not places that it's an easy process to set up the type of facilities that were set up in China, where you had, you know, an authoritarian regime that made things easy for business to take advantage of in terms of investing in the country, and a well-educated, relatively compliant workforce. I mean, that's not Africa. Mm-hmm. So, and the scale of external investment that would require, and the number of people that you're talking about to offset the number that will not be working in the part of the Japanese workforce is huge, mm-hmm. and probably bigger than anything that Africa could supply.
Interesting. So, you know, Daryl, this kind of brings me to this idea that I was trying to separate these two things, is understanding how we can look at this from, let's say, a sovereign country standpoint versus the economics of the country. You know, if they are able to export some of this labor force that is needed, that will be obviously positive for China. However, on the other side, you know, you don't really have the young people in country to be able to take care of the elderly population. So is there really, you know, two different ways to look at it from an economic perspective versus this at home perspective? Or does it end up really being intertwined because of the really the conclusions that we come to because of this aging population?
It's number two.
Mm-hmm. We can't really untangle.
No. That is a real stretch for Africa to be able to displace the manufacturing that's been created in China. Mm-hmm. You know, I guess stranger things have happened, but, you know, it's not obvious how this would work. And the second thing, as that's happening, at the same time, they have the most rapidly aging population in the world, significant size population. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the one that I usually drop on people that they don't realize is, you know, the median age of an American today is 38. The median age of someone in China today is 39. So the Chinese population is already older than the American population, is aging way more rapidly than the American population. So you sit back and you say, okay, non-consumptive, old population that requires a lot of public services in a country which doesn't have a national welfare system, mm-hmm. in which basically the way that they structure senior care is that sons take care of parents, and they're not having large numbers of sons. large numbers of offspring to be able to manage dealing with two older parents. Mm-hmm. At the same time, as they're trying to continue to drive economic growth with the only thing that they have, which is basically accessible, efficient, and relatively cheap labor, which no longer exists. It's a diminishing commodity for them every day. Or it's not a commodity, it's a diminishing advantage for them every day. So the challenges are huge. And at the same time that they're trying to be a global empire, they've got aspirations for territorial expansion in the region. It's really, really a difficult situation that China finds itself in. But yet, as I said before, I still go to these conferences and get regaled by these stories about what incredibly good shape China is in comparison to the United States. It's like, based on what? Mm-hmm. I mean, these challenges that we're talking about, there's no China without the Chinese. Mm-hmm. And what we're talking about is the Chinese, the actual people. The physical beings that constitute that country, and they're going through a massive transformation, mm-hmm. and one that works against the economic prospects of China, not for it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why I was trying to separate out those two pieces, and I just kind of kept coming to the conclusion, as I read the book, as I thought about this more, that you can't really untangle these two different ways of looking at it.
You can't.
And of course, a lot of that is a consequence of their one-child policy, right?
No, actually, their fertility rate, they'd already solved their problem with their fertility rate, which was too large back in the 60s. It had already been in pretty rapid decline already before the one-child policy. The one-child policy basically took the ski jump that they went down in terms of fertility decline and greased it. But the decline was already taking place. It was one of the single most destructive public policy initiatives that any country has ever launched. Completely unnecessary, and it has really imperiled what their future is going to be.
So, Daryl, if we look out, just to kind of circle back on that, if we look out, when are your best estimates for when the global population peaks now?
Oh, somewhere between 2040 and 2050.
Okay.
It'll probably peak at around, under 9 billion. So we hit 8. There's, the UN celebrated its 8 billion day last year or whenever it was. Mm-hmm. There's going to be no 9 billion day. Unless their data are wonky. Mm-hmm. And they have been wonky for the last while, but there should really be no 9 billion day. And then the question is, how far down does it go? Nobody knows.
Right. I'd like to give you another example. Obviously, this is something that comes from the show, and I'd like to get your thoughts on it. I've had the argument before that inflation in the US that was experienced in the 70s and the early 80s was actually mostly curbed by the aging baby boomer demographic rather than Paul Volcker raising interest rates. How plausible do you think that explanation is?
As long as consumption is declining, as we would see normal types of consumption, it probably has some effect on it. And there's been a couple of books I just read on inflation in a low population kind of situation. And I think economists are having a hard time getting their heads around it because we've never faced it before. Mm-hmm. So what the actual, as you said, with China, being able to separate these things is a little difficult. So how all of this stuff merges together, it's a little hard to see. Mm-hmm. But definitely the potential for slower growth, economic growth, is definitely there. What will happen with inflation, particularly since a lot of what was in kind of private sector, economic activity, some of that, those funds for things like defense and other things, are going to find themselves into dealing with a senior population, and how that's going to play out in terms of driving government spending, which obviously has a big impact on inflation, remains to be seen. What happens when people start spending their considerable savings, real estate or otherwise, mm-hmm. in terms of making sure they live their best golden years up to the end of their life? I mean, one of the things I say to people in financial services all the time is, you keep talking about this great wealth transfer, it's going to be later and less than you think.
Mm-hmm. Because people are going to be spending
on healthcare.
I was going to say a lot of that ends up just getting spent on healthcare.
Quality of life issues, yeah. Mm-hmm. So how it all works out, there's all of these moving parts, but where the thinking has to start is where we were an empty planet, which is to say, this is the scenario of the future, not Malthus, not the UN, not the the world, you know, population is out of control and we're a bunch of locusts and a plague on the earth. It's not that. Mm-hmm. It's another scenario. And when you start thinking about all the implications of this, it's tremendous. It is going to be, you know, the single biggest thing that is going to affect humanity over the course of this next century, because it's never happened before. We don't know what the effect is going to be. Yes, global warming is going to be really important too. Climate change is going to be really important too. But the difference between climate change and this one is we're not... it's not about scenarios. I mean, basically what you can do is you can take the data that relate to population because the decisions are already made and mark what's going to happen on the calendar. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're just going to live through it. I mean, there's no way to really change this or turn it around or do anything about it. We're just going to go through it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, that's an important point. There's no real way to change this. And I mean, you guys do a great job of explaining that in the book. At what, you know, child per woman level, do we have to stay above, or once we fall below, really spells the end for a lot of these populations?
Well, it's there's a concept called the low fertility trap. Mm-hmm. So once you get down to this level, you never get back. And the number is somewhere between 1.5, 1.3. And a lot of countries, you know, throughout the world are there or are getting there. Mm-hmm. So it's just like, once you get to there, it's pretty difficult to get back. And the reason is because it becomes a social norm. So in my country right now, where I'm speaking to you from in Canada, the most common number of children in a household is one. Mm-hmm. And the birth rate in Canada is 1.3, lowest in history. Mm-hmm. United States, it's a bit higher. It's 1.6, but also declining. And the reason it's declining is for all the things that I said previously. Mm-hmm. It's probably going to be headed in the same direction. At what point it'll happen, difficult to say, but it's not going in the other direction. So is the United States in a low fertility trap? Probably, which is why immigration is so important, right? Because it's really, in the short term, it's one of the only things that you can do to offset this. Mm-hmm. But the problem with it, of course, is immigrants don't come in at the age of zero. So it's like a blunting effect. It's not a changing effect. Mm-hmm.
That's actually exactly where I wanted to go next, was, you know, bringing in this idea of immigration and asking you if we only have to be, you know, squarely focused on skilled immigrants coming into the country, or as the U.S. has seen, kind of bringing in all kinds of different people. Like, should these Western countries be focused on, you know, vetting the immigrants that they're trying to bring in, or should they be trying to bring anybody and everybody that they can at this point?
If you would have asked me that 5 years ago, I probably would have said skilled immigrants only. Mm-hmm. But now, I mean, we need people to take care of the elderly. Mm-hmm. So there's some certain skills that are associated with that, but we need doctors, sure, but we need nurses assistants too. So I think that there's a range, mm-hmm. but the problem that we have with this is that it is an unbelievably difficult political scenario to manage. Mm-hmm. And as you're seeing in the United States, it is the spark that lights off the populist fire, but it's not just in the United States. We're going to see it in the European parliamentary elections that are coming up in June. I mean, people's reaction to cultural and demographic change as a result of immigration tends not to be friendly.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, obviously there's always the scenario of, you know, the NIMBY syndrome, right? Not in my backyard. But when we consider where these populations are headed and is going to take care of the elderly population, I can completely understand where you're coming from. Daryl, what role do environmental chemicals, you know, have on impacting, let's say, hormonal disruption in fertility rates around the world as well?
Well, there's a really good book on this by somebody I've had the pleasure of sharing a couple of panels with, Shauna Swan, called Countdown. Mm-hmm. And that's basically her argument. Mm-hmm. I'm not a a chemist. I'm not a biological scientist. So I have to go with what Sean is saying. And she claims that there's a pretty big impact. I think that if there is, fine. But the thing that's been happening with humanity is really psychological. It's cultural. We've just changed our view about what our need is to participate in creating the next generation. And we've decided, you know what? One or none, and maybe a dog or two.
Yeah.
And maybe an extra vacation.
Yeah.
We're just not interested. Mm-hmm. I mean, and there, for those people who are interested, they face some of those other challenges that Sean is talking about. But I would say the bigger factor is the cultural one.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, obviously, you know, we can point to different cultures that, you know, have more children, but, you know, I think that really, as you said, it really only applies to Africa in this day and age, right?
Yeah. And there are certain religious groups that tend to have higher birth rates, certain, you know, cultural communities that might have higher birth rates, but none of them, all of them are rounding errors in terms of the population. And by the way, you know, even when we mention Africa, there's been a pretty rapid decline in fertility rates in Africa too. Mm-hmm. So this is, whatever we're talking about for Africa is a fairly temporary situation. Mm-hmm. They're going to follow the rest of the world. Maybe they'll be, you know, a few decades later, but they're going to decline too.
Yeah, it's, you know, again, in the book, you go through this idea of immigration and how these different cultural groups really end up adopting the birth rate of the country that ends up adopting, right?
Yeah, and because it is, as I said before, it's culturally derived, right? I mean, mm-hmm. it's if you see a family living next door and they have five kids, well, you know, maybe that's what the family looks like. And back in 1960 in Canada and the United States, the average woman had between three and four kids, mm-hmm. right? That was the average. Now it's like one, if at all. Mm-hmm. And as a result, the new norm, the new social norm, is small families. Mm-hmm.
So, Daryl, you know, after this discussion, it seems pretty gloomy. Is there anything that can be done to either reverse this trend or, you know, see any positives out of this situation?
Well, there are some people who, you know, people in the degrowth movement see this as a really positive thing. I mean, you know, where human activity has despoiled the planet, the fewer of us, the better. The less consumption that we have, the better it is for all things to do with the environment. They, of course, grossly underestimate what the impact of that kind of transition will be, mm-hmm. but they would see it as a positive thing. But beyond that, it's something that has to be managed. And really, the purpose of writing Empty Planet was to just fire the flare and say, look, people, this is what's really going on, rather than this narrative about, you know, we have to control the growth of the human population. Well, it's actually pretty much under control now. And we're going to go down the other side of the mountain, but we're going to do it in the dark because nobody's ever done this before. And we don't really know what the implications are. Mm-hmm. And by the way, on the way up, we did the same thing. I mean, nobody had been through that rapid expansion of population that we went through to the same degree as the Western world in particular went through as a result of the baby boom. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we learned a whole bunch of things there that were pretty disruptive. We're going to learn a whole bunch of things on the other way down that's pretty disruptive too. But, you know, human beings are remarkably adaptable. I'm sure we will figure it out. But the world that we're going to live in, your kids are going to live in particular, is going to be pretty different from the one that we grew up in. Mm-hmm. And all because of this change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as you say, you know, you brought up this idea that there have been many people throughout history that have sounded this alarm. So what do you think the difference is now?
Well, I think the what's changed is the data's caught up to it. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, so the data are so compelling that it's difficult to claim what, you know, interest groups on the side of depopulation are claiming that, you know, the global population is out of control and it's going to grow forever. I mean, even the UN, its numbers, I mean, anybody who pays any attention to this topic doesn't regard their projections as being very credible mm-hmm. anymore. You know, in the short term, yes, but in the longer term, no. And given that they adjust them every 2 years, I mean, by the time we get to the end of the century, they'll be probably where I'm talking about, because that'll be those will be the facts. But we've never dealt with this situation before. It never has never happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's certainly an important lesson to be able to, let's say, wrap our heads around and kind of bring into view here, because of, you know, making sure we're understanding this problem properly. So, Daryl, I appreciate you coming on today to share your thoughts with us. Is there anything else you'd like to leave our audience with before we wrap up?
Yeah, you know, for people in the mining sector, and anybody who's in the natural resources business, the implications of this are profound. Mm-hmm. I mean, so if you're out there, you know, collecting all sorts of rare earths and that kind of thing, because you think that there's going to be a level of automotive production going forward that's similar to what we experienced under the baby boom, mm-hmm. you're probably wrong. I mean, urbanization is continuing. Our driving distances are, on average, getting smaller. You know, all the things that we need in the, in a robust growing economy are not going to be the same as they are going to be in the economy going forward. So making smart choices mm-hmm. about long-term bets when it comes to things like, for example, mines and starting mines and bringing new supplies into production, you might want to just think for a second about what you and I are talking about today.
About what that demand picture actually looks like from a population view.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So if you're assuming, like, you know, I deal with a lot of agriculture groups. For some reason, they love me to come in and talk about these things. It's like they're constantly told, you know, ramp it up, guys. We've got to feed 11.2 billion people. And it's like, no, you don't. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be that at all. Mm-hmm. It's going to be quite a bit smaller than that. And by the way, the people that you're going to be feeding are going to be living more in suburbs and cities than they are in the countryside. And they're not going to be as many of them, and they're going to be a lot older. Mm-hmm. So when you hear that scenario, what agricultural production is the best match for that? It's the same thing for mining. What is going to be the demand for all of these things? Mm-hmm. Well, maybe you should just think about it a little bit and maybe bring in some of these scenarios and look at the correlation between population decline and what happens in economies. Japan's a good place to start, mm-hmm. but there's other places that are even potentially even more dire, like Italy mm-hmm. and Portugal and Spain. Eastern Europe right now is collapsing. I mean, it's disappearing. They stopped having kids.
I remember an example from the book in Hungary, which is actually where my grandmother's from. They're going to lose, what was it, something like 20% of their population in the next, it was like the next 10 years or something like that, 20 years?
Which is why Orban, their leader, has nationalized in vitro fertilization as a state asset. They're now, any woman who has four kids or more pays no taxes. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're getting desperate.
Yeah. And I mean, those are both examples of reactions to a problem that, you know, for all intents and purposes, seems to be already in a way predetermined, right?
Yeah, that's why I said the decisions are basically made. Just mark them on your calendar. We're going to live through this. But I can't tell you the last time I sat through a mining presentation, anybody mentioned anything about population. Mm-hmm. Just never happens.
Well, that's why I'm trying to bring this up, Daryl.
Yeah, they get into excruciating detail about all sorts of engineering issues and all sorts of other things, as though the marketplace that they're supplying is continuing to grow, and it's mm-hmm. not going to.
Excellent. Well, again, for anybody that wants to read that book, it's called Empty Planet, The Shock of Global Depopulation or Global Decline. And Daryl's available on Twitter as well, at Daryl Bricker, D-A-R-R-E-L-L, Bricker. Excellent Twitter follow. You back up a lot of what we talked about today with all the stats, and available at Ipsos.com as well. Daryl, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.